All right. Well, so this morning we're starting chapter 5 in John's Gospel, everybody has a handout, I hope so. Beginning here in chapter 5, we see a new theme emerge, in the Gospel, which will kind of weave its way all the way through the rest of the story, and that theme is Jesus being on trial. Now, when we think about Jesus being on trial, where does our mind immediately go? It's like at the end, right, when he's on trial before Pilate. And that is kind of the only trial that's presented in the synoptic gospels. But actually in John's gospel, Jesus gets put on trial here in chapter 5. He gets put on trial again later in chapter 7, and then again in chapter 9. And it's kind of like a ongoing theme of Jesus being put on trial, charges being brought against him by the religious establishment, and then him having to defend himself on the basis of those charges. And it's it's really kind of interesting the way that John presents it here. You know, he presents Jesus as being on trial all throughout the story. And so from a literary perspective, in terms of the story that John is framing and what he's trying to get across, good morning, Bill. The point that's being made is that the arrival of Jesus into the world forces men and women who encounter him, which includes us 2,000 years later, right, to appraise who he really is, to examine him, to decide the veracity of his mission and the veracity of his word. And so, Jesus being on trial is actually an important part of this gospel, because we're confronted with who he is, and then we have to make a judgment about who he is. And that's what's happening in these settings, that he's confronting the religious establishment. They're actually in opposition to him and putting him to trial. He's having to defend himself by bringing forth testimony, which in some cases is the works that he does. In some cases, it's the testimony of other people. He's already referred to the testimony of John the Baptist about him. He'll be referring to the testimony of God himself about him, the testimony of people. Testimony comes forth, and everything is really presented. We'll even notice in the language today, it's the language of a courtroom, of testimony, of verdicts, and it's just really interesting. The twist in all of this, which is really interesting, is that, and it was really the irony of it, is that in the end, it's not Jesus who's actually on trial, is it? Right? rather it's the world is on trial on the basis of who he is, and the religious system of Judaism is on trial to see whether or not the world and the religious system accepts him for who he is, for who he reveals himself to be, or whether it rejects him. And so we're on trial. But she's not queuing up yet. Yeah. Oh, that's okay. Let me make sure that she has the right. You can tell her to try again. If she can't get in, I might need to resend her a link. All right. So anyway, that's kind of the irony. And also what's ironic about it, even though Jesus is being put on trial, even though, it's kind of the world in essence that's being put on trial by him, he says that his mission in his first coming is not to judge the world. He says that twice in this gospel. I didn't come to judge the world. Although, we know that in his second coming, that's exactly what he's going to do. He's going to bring judgment. But that was not the purpose of his first entry into the world. But even though he didn't come to bring judgment, still, he is the light of the world, which when that light enters into the darkness, it does expose the darkness for what it is, and it judges it for what it is. And so just recall what we saw in chapter 3. It's the first passage on your page, John 3:19. This is the verdict. Light has come into the world. Notice the language there. It says this is what? The verdict. That's trial language, right? This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but people loved darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. So even though, we see the world putting Jesus on trial and judging him, it's really the world that's being tried by the light. And the verdict rendered by the light coming into the darkness is what? People love darkness instead of light. because their deeds were evil. You know, it's one of the remarkable things that gets revealed by the ministry of Jesus is, you know, even though he exposes those in darkness and, you know, to what they've been entrapped by, for some reason, they want to stay in the darkness and don't come into the light. You know, so it's very few, you know, in terms of Israel and in terms of the world in general, who actually accept the light and want to enter into it. Now what we've already seen in the gospel so far, you know, people examining Jesus and trying to figure him out, you know, Nicodemus and the Samaritan woman, that's what they're doing in their questions. You know, they're trying to, you know, they're examining him and trying to understand who he is and where he comes from. Now in this chapter and in the ones to come, we'll see the Jewish leaders examine Jesus in ways that are very much presented as Jesus being on trial. That's because all of the essential elements of a trial are present. There's the perceived crime that gets established. There's the indictment, you know, basically why they're wanting to bring these charges against them. What the, you know, where those who are in charge want to, you know, the charges they want to bring against him. And then Jesus has to produce witnesses to testify to who he is and to what he's doing. And then he has to produce evidence that substantiates his claims, which are primarily his works. Now in this chapter, the next passage, John 5:36, we're not going to get to that today, but just looking ahead to what we'll see next week, I have testimony weightier than that of John, for the works the Father has given me to finish, the very works that I am doing, testify that the Father has sent me. So again, notice the language of a trial, testimony. You know, it's kind of wild because I've been reading this the last couple of weeks, and it's almost like for the first time I noticed all this language, you know, of trial language, and then started to see that, wow, this is really what's being presented here. And as you go through, it happens over and over again, Jesus being put on trial. And you know, the way that John frames all this is really fascinating. And what's really amazing, fascinating, sad in a lot of ways, is that the various trials of Jesus that are being presented in this gospel, you know, culminate in the end, where Jesus appears before Pilate, who actually finds Jesus innocent, right? He actually finds no basis for a charge against him. But nevertheless, Jesus gets put to death, even though he's found innocent at his final trial. So let's look at that just real quick. It's looking way ahead. John 18, verse 36. This is Jesus standing on trial before Pilate. Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate, because that's the essence in terms of Rome, you know, whether or not Jesus is guilty of anything, if he's claiming to be a king in opposition to Caesar. He says, "You are a king then." Jesus answered, "You say that I'm a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." "What is truth?" retorted Pilate. With this, he went out again to the Jews gathered there and said, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." You know, so basically, you know, he says, I've examined him. I find no basis for a charge against him. But because of the insistence of the Jewish leaders to crucify him, Pilate acquiesced and actually puts Jesus to death, even though he's found innocent at the final trial. So the judicial background is essential because it sets the stage for what we're going to see here in chapter 5 and for a lot of other things that are happening as we go along. And here we see what becomes a template for the gospels, this gospel's message of accusation and response, because Jesus gets accused of doing certain things, he responds. He gets accused, he responds. And that manifests itself into actually a prosecution of him and a defense that happens in this chapter, and it happens in several other places as we go through the gospel. All right, so when we look at chapter 5, verses 1 through 15 is actually what we're given the alleged crime. And when we get to it, it's pretty wild, you know, what they're accusing Jesus of and the crime that they say that he's committed. Verses 16 to 18 is their decision to prosecute him, the religious leader's decision to prosecute him. And then finally, verses 19 to 47, which we'll do next time, is the trial itself, where Jesus presents his case. He not only does that, but he turns the tables against their accusers, and he actually winds up putting them on trial instead of him being on trial. They're the ones who in the end wind up being on trial. All right, so what we'll see in this and the other trials that are going to follow is the kind of continual accusation and rejection that Jesus experienced, all right? And that the source of those accusations and the rejection is the religious leaders of the time, you know, the Jewish leaders. And also what we'll see is the pattern for his defense. And perhaps most importantly, what's being brought out in all of this and the way that it's done is the spiritual jeopardy of his opponents. Because when Jesus defends himself against their accusations, what he's really doing is showing them kind of their own spiritual jeopardy in rejecting him and rejecting the message and rejecting the veracity of the evidence that he presents. And so let's start with the alleged crime. The verse one, we'll read the whole thing and then go back and kind of break it down as we go along. So starting in John chapter 5, verse 1. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the festivals. Now there is in Jerusalem near the sheep gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here, a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." But he replied, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" So they asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?" The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who had made him well. All right, so this is really an interesting story, and it begins with Jesus coming to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. And as we said before, you know, in contrast to the Synoptic Gospels, you know, of which really Jesus, all of the activity in the Synoptic Gospels happened in Galilee until the very end. Then he goes to Jerusalem, you know, and for the one time. But in John's Gospel, almost all of it takes place in Jerusalem. You know, he's going up to these various festivals, which the Jews are required to attend. And this story begins with him going up to one of those festivals. It doesn't really specify which one it is. But it says he came to the pool at Bethesda, which was commonly known as a healing sanctuary, you know, a place of healing. Look at verse 2. Now there is in Jerusalem, near the sheep gate, pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here, a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. Now, obviously, the people of Jesus' time believed that there was some sort of miraculous power in the pool, because it says that a great number of disabled people used to lie there, the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. And why were they there? Is they were all hoping to get healed. Okay. Now the question that's raised is, why did they believe that they could be healed by being at the pool? Now I want you to notice something. Look at on your sheet, look at verse 3. And at the end of verse 3, in between verse 3 and verse 5, you notice there's not a verse 4. It skips from 3 to 5. And there's a little superscript at the end of verse 3 that has 4 in brackets, right? All right, so let me just kind of explain to you what that is. In the newer translations of the Bible, which being the NIV or all the ones that have been done, you know, in the late 20th century and since then, they were all based on earlier manuscripts that had been found and substantiated after later manuscripts that were used to translate the King James and some of the older translations of the Bible. Okay, so in terms of textual criticism and understanding what's the most reliable manuscripts of the Bible to translate it from, you know, the older the better. The closer you get to the source, the more reliable it is, because over time there's different kind of corruptions get into the text because people, you know, scribes would put in comments. And so there was a large number of verses in the NIV that are omitted in the NIV that would have been present in the King James. And most of those are generally believed to have been things that were added over time and not part of the original manuscript. And this is a case of one of those things. And so when you're reading in one of these newer translations, the NIV in particular, you know, it'll add a little 4 in there. And you can look down at the bottom of the page, and it actually gives you the verse that's missing that was in the older manuscripts, but that was in the older translations, but not in the most reliable manuscripts. Okay, so if you look at the bottom where of this reference for verse 4, the verse that's not there, I didn't put it on your sheet, but just listen. I'll read you what it says. The note at the bottom of the page says some manuscripts include here wholly or in part. You know, at the end of the word paralyzed, here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the lame, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. And this is what was added. And they waited for the moving of the waters. From time to time, an angel of the Lord would come down and stir up the waters. The first one into the pool after each such disturbance would be cured of whatever disease they had. So it's kind of an explanation that gets added in later on to the original manuscript of why these people were waiting around, you know. And it's not part of the original text, but that doesn't mean there's not value in the explanation, because what is part of the original text is him saying that I have no one to help me get into the pool when it gets stirred. Well, the tradition was that an angel would come that would stir the water, and the first person who got into the pool, once the water got stirred, would get healed. Now, you can imagine if you're paralyzed and you don't have anybody to help you, that would be kind of a frustrating situation, wouldn't it? I mean, lying there for years and years, and it's like the makings of a Monty Python scene. but that would be quite frustrating. You look perplexed, my dear. And so that's kind of what the man's explaining to Jesus here. So I'm laying here waiting to get healed. But when the water gets stirred, there's nobody to help me get in. And so therefore I miss out on the opportunity. Okay, so looking back at verse 5 again. One who was there, and this is the man who got healed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. I mean, that's a long time, right? Most of his life, surely. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for such a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" Interesting question, right? All right, so just imagine the scene here. All right, so Jesus walks into what's basically a hospital. You know, a great number of people lying around wanting to get healed. It's a shaded pool surrounded by these 5 colonnades, so it's a good place to hang out. You know, there's a shade there and full of people who are hoping to get miraculously made well. And so in that scene, Jesus walks up to one person and says, "Do you want to get well?" You know, you have to love how Jesus gets right to the point, right? It's like, okay, let's just get to the heart of the matter. You know, you're laying here, you've been here for a long time. I'm going to take the initiative. Do you want to get well? Now, what we'll see is, as we read this, is that the man had no clue who Jesus was, right? I mean, here's a stranger walks up to him and asks him a question, do you want to get well? But in response to Jesus' question, the man explains his predicament. Verse 7, sir, the invalid replied, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me. So somebody else beats me in. And like I said, I just imagine how frustrating that must have been for the man, because there was no way, given his condition, that he could outrace the others to be the first into the water once it got stirred. Obviously, whatever tradition that was had a good bit of superstition involved in it. Who knows? There must have been some healings at some point to have caused so many people to lay around that way. But Jesus just kind of cuts through all the superstitious faith in order to reveal to the man the one who truly does have the authority and the power to make him well. All right, verse 8. Then Jesus said to him, get up, pick up your mat and walk. At once, the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. So, basically Jesus is saying, get yourself up and start walking. And the healing was immediate. I mean, really remarkably. And like I said, interestingly, this man had no clue who Jesus was. Lots of times, there's a lot of teaching that says, okay, well, healing is based on the amount of faith that we have in Jesus. Our healing is based on that. Well, here's a evidence from scripture of someone who had no clue who Jesus was. How could he possibly have faith in Jesus' power to heal him? It really is kind of this miracle happened independent of the man's faith in Jesus or his confession of Jesus. All right. He had no idea that this man, who he was, much less his ability to be able to heal him. And so, in other words, this healing was not a result of the man's faith in Jesus. He simply received the authority of Jesus' command and obeyed by being healed. Jesus said, get up and pick up your mat. And there was such authority and power in the words, the guy did what he was told. He got up at once, picked up his mat, and began walking. All right, so that's an awesome story, right? And so where's the crime in that? what's the source of the accusation that not only causes people to oppose Jesus, the religious leaders, but as we're going to read, causes them to want to kill him because of this? Right, yeah, I mean, it's go ahead. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you went to Germany a couple weeks ago. Y'all went too. Y'all saw it. And so this is an event that happens once every 30 years or something, 20 years or something? Every 10 years? Okay. So they actually acted out this scene in that show. Cool.
They're walking in there in the Roman temple window.
Uh-huh.
Anyway,
cool. Right, yeah. Awesome. All right, so what was the crime? What about this would cause the religious authorities to make accusations that Jesus was breaking the law? Well, the answer is that the healing occurred on the Sabbath. And there was two offenses that Jesus made here. First of all, for some reason, the Jewish interpretation of Sabbath regulations had gotten to the point where they felt like healing was work and therefore should not be done on the Sabbath. Okay, so that's number one. Number two is to pick up your mat and to carry it from point A to point B on the Sabbath was also interpreted to be work and therefore against the law. Both would be breaking the Sabbath regulations that had been established by the Jewish leaders. And so, Jesus did both. And he healed the man and broke the Sabbath, according to them, in doing so. And he ordered the man to pick up his mat and walk, to pick and carry his mat, which, the man did. And therefore, that also broke their interpretation of Sabbath rules. So look on the back of your page, which is the middle of verse 9. It says, the day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, it is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat. I mean, it's... So the response of the Jewish leaders is pretty telling. You know, they didn't rejoice that the man had been healed. And rather, their first response was to accuse him of breaking the Sabbath rules, which is really wild. Verse 11. But he replied, the man who made me well said to me, pick up your mat and walk. So the man's reply is understandable. He says, basically, the man who healed me, you know, the guy who spoke and healed me, said to pick up my mat. And so I did what he told me to do. And realized that he still has, at this point, still has no clue who Jesus is. He could point him out in a crowd if he saw him, but he had no idea what his name was. He had no idea what anything about him. All he knew is that he had experienced Jesus' authority and had been healed according to the power of the word spoken to him by this stranger who came up to him in this hospital. And it's the case with this man, but whenever we truly encounter God, you know, man-made rules and opinions no longer matter, do they? I mean, this guy had really encountered God, and in encountering God, you know, it's like, it doesn't matter what people tell me. I've experienced something that's way beyond the authority of normal people. You know, it's way beyond the rules of whatever religious system there may be in place, you know, and that's what this man had done. He had experienced the power and the mercy and the compassion of his creator God. And that was consuming him in that moment. And none of that other stuff really, really mattered. You know, the joy of encountering God supersedes all that stuff. It supersedes the opinion of man. It supersedes the man-made rules and regulations. Now, that's the man's perspective. The legalists, on the other hand, the religious leaders, they can't see the activity of God or at work in front of their face. You know, they're so caught up in their rules and their indignation over people breaking them that they can't see what God is doing in their midst. And that's exactly what's happening here. All right, verse 12. So they asked him, this being the religious leaders, asked him, who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk? And the man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. All right, now here the gospel takes kind of an ominous turn. All right, this is a turning point in John's gospel, because what gets revealed at this point is the hostility of Jesus' opponents is beginning to get revealed. You know, their opposition to him. And like I was saying, it's not just a mild amount of opposition. It's a degree of opposition that actually wants to put him to death, even at this early stage. And again, this is something really different in John's gospel. I mean, it's kind of like, John's gospel makes this right up front. You know, the hostility against Jesus in the synoptics doesn't come out until a good bit later. But here it's just right up front. You know, Jesus is opposed, and opposed to the point where his opponents want to kill him. They want him out of the way so bad that they want him to be dead. Their opposition is not focused on the error of the man. So in other words, when this man who's healed picks up his mat and walks and they confront him about this, it's not him really that they're after. They're after the one who healed him and who instructed him to break the Sabbath. You know, they're after the Sabbath breaker, basically, is what they're asking, what they're after. And so they ask, who is this fellow? You know, tell us so that we can prosecute him. I mean, that's their heart in this, you know, totally ignoring the fact that a man who had been paralyzed for 38 years is now miraculously walking. I mean, it seems like they would, you know, they would just be rejoicing with him. I mean, this, but that's how powerful man-made religious rules can be to blind you to the work of God that's going on right in front of you. And that's what's happening here. You know, they were much more concerned about that than about a man being set free from captivity to the devil. And so that's what they want to do. They want to know who did it so they can prosecute him. But the man who was healed still didn't have any clue who Jesus was. And he couldn't even point Jesus out because Jesus had slipped away in the crowd. Now that's also a pattern that we see in Jesus. Because, you know, what would happen today if, somebody, a man had been paralyzed for 38 years and somebody prays for him or whatever in the church, a minister, a pastor or whatever, and he gets miraculously healed. I mean, they'd make commercials about it, right? it'd be on the flyers. It'd be out front on the reader board. Come here. see the healer. Jesus wasn't like that. Jesus has slipped away into the crowd because he wasn't really, you know, he was doing his thing and he wasn't interested in drawing attention to himself, which is very revealing, right? Because you'd think, all right, you know, one of the things you always wonder about Jesus is why didn't he walk in there and heal every single person there and just do something so miraculous that they couldn't deny who he was? Well, you know, we'll see later on in this gospel, I'm not doing this on my own authority. I'm only doing what I see the Father doing. You know, the Father didn't tell me to heal everybody in this place. You know, I was instructed to heal and equipped and enabled and empowered by the Father to heal this one guy. And that's what I did. And then he slipped off and, you know, wasn't trying to draw attention to himself. He was just ministering the mercy and the compassion of the Father towards this one individual. And then afterwards, he just kind of quietly slipped away. He wasn't looking to make a name for himself by doing this. He was just...
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because we'll see in the next chapter, you know, after he feeds the 5,000, you know, they wanted to come and do what? Make him king by force, you know, which wasn't his mission. And so he had to slip away to get away from the crowds. You know, it wasn't, you know, his mission was not to do such miraculous things that he was elevated to a position by the men around him. No, he had a path to take, which was so contrary to the to the wisdom of man, because, you know, the foolishness of God is infinitely greater than the wisdom of man. The wisdom of man would say, okay, Jesus, do your thing in such an undeniable way that they would have made you king. But no, I mean, that's not God's plan. The God's plan was for him to suffer the injustice of that final trial, being innocent and yet being put to death, and then to be exalted by the Father in a way that that came from his obedience and his humility. Jesus
wanted to crucify every lawbreaker.
Pardon me?
They wanted to crucify every lawbreaker.
The Jews?
Yeah.
No, I mean, it was very unusual. Okay, so in terms of the Roman, you know, the crucifixion was the Roman way of putting people to death. And it was reserved for two groups of people. One was incorrigible slaves who not just ran away once, but continued to run away. And the idea was that by crucifying them, they would be put on display as a deterrent to other slaves wanting to do that. The second class of people who would be crucified would be insurrectionists, those who are opposed to the Roman state and wanting to overthrow it. So political enemies, basically. And so it's the latter that Jesus is accused of being. You know, when it says that Jesus is crucified between two thieves on the cross, that's actually a bad English translation, because they weren't thieves in the sense that the reason they were being crucified is because they stole something. No, they were insurrectionists who, as part of their uprising against the state, did steal. But the reason they were crucified is because they were trying to overthrow Rome's rule in in the region. So notice it's really unusual for the Jews to have they claim that they didn't have the authority to put someone to death. That's why they came to Rome and asked it. But so it's totally unusual. I mean, just way outside the norm. All right. Yes.
But it had to be calculated. I mean, Jesus knew what day it was. And he did just enough to stir up the authorities, and then it could disappear. But his mission was to set in place this, get this hostility going.
Well, yeah. Well, he's going to draw it out just by being who he was,
right.
And we'll see it. You know, one of the great points of the reasons for the opposition between the religious leaders and Jesus was not so much about who Jesus was or what he was doing, and we'll see this in just a minute in what we're about to read. It was about the difference between him and them on who God is and what he's really like. Because, you know, the essential matter, yes, healing on the breaking the Sabbath was part of it. But there was a deeper thing than that, which was Jesus' claim that God was his father. And that was blasphemous to them. But, what was blasphemy to them was really an incredible revelation to us about the nature of God. And so Jesus, he had a different perspective on who God is that ran totally contrary to the religious leaders' belief of who the God they worshiped was. And they just couldn't accept Jesus' perspective on who God was, because the issue that boils down to, they were afraid they were going to lose their power, right? Their authority. You know, the Romans are going to come and take away our place because Jesus was a threat to their authority. The way that he related to the Father and the relationship to the Father that he came to bring was also a threat to their authority, because now all of a sudden, the children of God can relate to him one-on-one. We don't have to do it necessarily through a religious system that's regulated and by man. So all of that was offensive. So yes, he stirred him up for sure. And a lot of the messianic secret, a lot of the times when, we said in the synoptics, a big issue is the messianic secret, where Jesus, actually tells people, he tells the demons, don't speak about this, don't reveal, because the demons knew right away who he was. He said, shut up, don't talk about this. We know he would hide himself because he was trying to keep that under wraps until the proper time. That's not so much the case here, but all of it is stirring up the religious authorities and leading to the cross. And it is a timing issue because, he'll do something and then he makes himself scarce because the time is not right for the climax of the opposition. So
this also sounds like he was paralyzed because of sin.
Well, we're going to talk about that. Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Okay, so the man didn't have any clue. Now, later that day, Jesus did seek the man out. Okay, so verse 14. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you are well again." Okay, so later on, Jesus sought him out, found him at the temple, the man. "See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who made him well. Okay, now I know who it is. It's this guy. All right, so Jesus' statement here raises some interesting questions in regard to sin and sickness. As Jesus says really plainly, stop sinning. See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you. Now, in general, the belief at the time of Jesus amongst the Jewish belief was that there was a correlation between the degree of one's sin and their physical health. In other words, somebody who's in really bad physical state obviously is that way because they're an extremely prolific sinner. And Jesus here seems to at least be acknowledging that belief, but maybe not necessarily agreeing with it, although it sounds in a way that he's agreeing with it. Now, we know that Jesus doesn't totally agree with that, the correlation, because of an encounter that happens later in chapter 9, which I put on the sheet, chapter 9, verse 1. As he went along, he, Jesus, saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" So again, that's kind of the general belief. This man was born blind. Obviously, there was some great sin that happened because it was a horrible thing to be not just born blind. And so the question would be, all right, well, so this guy, he was blind from birth. You know, was it his sin somehow in the womb that caused this to happen? Or was it his parents who sinned that caused it to happen? But Jesus responds, verse 3, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned." He wasn't blind because they sinned, that he sinned or his parents sinned. But this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. So God had a purpose in his blindness. And that purpose was that Jesus would heal him, which there were three. Well, and again, John's gospel points this out, which the others don't. But the Jewish belief at the time was one of the identifying evidences of the Messiah was there would be three miracles that he would perform that had never been done before and would only be possible by the Messiah. You know, obviously in the history of Israel, that, you know, the prophets would do miraculous stuff. There was a lot of things that happened that were miracles at the hands of the prophets, but there were three specific miracles that the Jews believed that only the Messiah would do. And again, it goes to this presenting evidence. You know, we'll see this. And those three, one of which was to heal a man born blind. You know, because that's kind of, one was to cast out a deaf and mute spirit, the reason for that is that the Jewish exorcists, there were Jewish exorcists who cast out demons. And one of their techniques in doing so was to ask the demon what its name was. And by gathering the name of the demon, then they could use the name against it to cast it out. And so Jesus actually used that technique with the Gerasene demon. He asked him, "What's your name?" And he said, "Legion," because there were so many of them. But if it was a deaf and mute spirit, so in other words, if the person who's been affected by it couldn't hear or couldn't speak, there was no way that technique could be used, right? So there had to be a greater authority to cast out a deaf and mute spirit, which they believed the Messiah would have. And the third evidence would be to not just raise a dead person, because that happened, you know, in the prophets, but to raise a dead person who had been dead more than 3 days, because the Jews believed that at the end of 3 days, then the soul has irrevocably left the body, and it was impossible then for that person to be raised. Well, that's what Jesus did with Lazarus. And when he completed that third of those signs, that's when the plot against him by the religious leaders to kill him totally, you know, takes on a whole new level of, you know, that's basically when his death warrant was signed, when he did that, which was the third of those last of the last signs. So I don't know what got us on that, but anyway, I forget the tangent. Sorry about that. All right. So,
moral of the story: don't take on this
staff. Yeah, I mean, yeah, they'll. The man. Watch out for the man. But luckily, we've got the man with a capital M, right? Yeah, it doesn't matter what they can do. What they can do to us. All right, so how do we reconcile all this? You know, why would Jesus say, "Go, don't sin anymore, or something worse may happen to you," versus, "No, it wasn't this man or his parents who sinned that caused him to be blind"? You know, the thing is, you know, Jesus came to set us free from the power of sin, right? And the consequences of sin, which is enslavement to our adversary who uses our sin against us in order to bring trouble in our lives. You know, he seeks to steal and kill and destroy. And the way that he does that is he uses the sin of mankind against us in order to bring that kind of destruction. All right. And Jesus came to set us free from that. But the truth is also we live in the midst of a fallen world. I mean, we still live in the midst of a fallen world, which is still subject to the consequences of sin being in this world, and which are physical consequences, which are sin and death. You know, eventually when Jesus returns and the kingdom is established in all of its fullness, there is not going to be any more sickness or death. But in the meantime, there is. And the reason for sickness and death being in this fallen world is sin. And even though we've been set free from the consequence of sin, which is death, that doesn't mean that we don't experience a physical death in our lives or that we don't experience illness, because we're living in the midst of an already, we're in already, but not yet. You know, the kingdom has already been established by Jesus, but it's not yet been consummated. And so therefore we, even the people of Jesus, are still subject to the consequences of sin in the world, which is sickness and death. And so given that, you know, there are sins which manifest physical consequences in the world, even for Christians, right? I mean, examples would be drug addiction, you know, alcoholism, sexual immorality, and all those things can lead to you having physical problems that are a result of that sin. And so not necessarily those being the cause, but those being the consequence of it. Okay. So what conclusion do we draw? You know, surely sickness and death entered the world because of sin. And so there's definitely a correlation between the two. Okay. But to say that the degree of a person's physical impairment is directly related to the measure of sin in their life is not substantiated by the gospel. Okay, I don't think that's the case. You know, both sickness and death are part of the already but not yet existence that we have. You know, even though we belong to the kingdom and we're kingdom people and we've been set free from the ultimate consequence of sin, which is death, doesn't mean we're not going to experience the physical death, nor does it mean that we're not going to experience the result of one of the outworkings of sin in the midst of the fallen world, which is sickness. Okay, because we're still not, we're in the not yet. it's already but not yet life, which we're living. So that's why Jesus said, you know, you've been set free from sin to this guy. Now go and sin no more, because if you do, something worse may indeed happen to you. I mean, yeah, because that's just kind of the nature of the beast. And then some things, you know, our sin can bring about physical troubles that aren't of the Lord and that, you know, that are contrary to us being set free by him. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's all the function of us living in the midst of the fallen world still. But there is no, you can't make a case from scripture for the common Jewish belief at the time was that the degree of your physical suffering is directly correlated to the degree of sin in your life. That's Jesus, you know, what we read in chapter 9 about the blind man, I think Jesus puts an end to that.
Does the Old Testament really talk about the already but not yet reality that's coming? I mean, I know it talks about in Ezekiel, the new covenant.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, now the Old Testament mostly points to, you know, to the consummation. What's life going to look like in the fullness of the consummation? Now, not that it's against that. I mean, one of the things that the disciples of Jesus had to reconcile after his death and resurrection and the coming of the Spirit was this already but not yet reality, because the Jews in the Old Testament believed that there was going to be a cataclysmic end to the present evil age, and then the kingdom in all of its fullness would begin. And so what the early disciples of Jesus had to realize was, no, this is actually a two-stage deal. There was an initial coming of Jesus when he would inaugurate the kingdom through his death and resurrection and the coming of the Spirit. but there would also be a second coming of Jesus, which would bring the cataclysmic end to the fallenness of the world and bring about the new creation in all of its fullness. And what they realized and what has come to be termed theologically is the already but not yet, is we're living in this age of overlap between the two. You know, the kingdom has begun, but the present evil age has not ended. And so, you know, that's why we have so much opposition in the world is that we are still living in this age of overlap. You know, we're still living in the midst of the fallen world that Satan, there is still a prince over this world who is hostilely opposed to who we are as the people of Jesus, because he knows the threat that we are to his existence and to his power. Does that answer your question, Steve?
Sure.
Okay, good. All right. Next, how much time we got? Okay, I think we've got time to get through this next little section. All right, so next in chapter 5 comes the decision by the Jewish leaders to prosecute Jesus. It's just 3 verses, but they're extraordinarily significant to understanding the Jewish leaders' opposition to Jesus. So starting in verse 16, John 5:16. So, because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. And the word persecute, if you look that up, you know, the Greek word for that is very similar and synonymous with the word prosecute. You know, they began to persecute and to prosecute him over this. Okay, again, trial language. The Jewish leaders began to persecute him. In his defense, Jesus said to them, "My Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working." For this reason, they tried all the more to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. All right, so these verses are basically John's commentary to explain the nature of Jesus' persecution by the religious leaders, okay? Now, the shocking conclusion of their opposition is they want to put him to death. They write up here up front, "For this reason, they tried all the more to kill him." So in saying this, you know, John here at this early stage of the gospel is pointing us to where the story's heading, right? Okay. So unlike with the synoptic gospels, where it's all kind of a mystery, and not until you get toward the end, you realize, hey, they're really out to kill him. If you're reading it for the first time, as if you didn't know. Here, right from the beginning, he's making it clear that's their purpose. They're out to kill him. And so from the perspective of the Jewish leaders, there were 2 offenses that Jesus had committed that were worthy of the death penalty. So in keeping with the trial motif, these are the basis of the prosecution's indictments of him. You know, so like what they've done now is they've indicted Jesus and they're wanting to bring him to trial, on these charges against him. So the first charge is not that he healed a man, but that he did so on the Sabbath. Okay, look at verse 16 again. So because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. So John's gospel and the synoptics both show the Sabbath regulations as a major point of contention between Jesus and the religious leaders. You know, they view Jesus not just as indifferent to the Sabbath requirements, but openly and blatantly hostile to them. You know, that's what they thought about Jesus. He's not just, you know, he's openly hostile. He's not just breaking the Sabbath himself. He's basically telling people that these Sabbath regulations are irrelevant now. And so that's their justification to persecute him. And there actually is justification in the law, you know, the law being the first 5 books of the Bible, for a death penalty for that kind of offense. I put one on here, Numbers chapter 15, verse 32, just so you can see. While the Israelites were in the wilderness, a man was found gathering wood on the Sabbath day. Those who found him gathering wood brought him to Moses and Aaron and the whole assembly, and they kept him in custody because it was not clear what should be done to him. Now, this is wild. Then the Lord said to Moses, "The man must die. The whole assembly must stone him outside the camp." So the assembly took him outside the camp and stoned him to death as the Lord commanded Moses. So pretty clear that, there was a death penalty for breaking the Sabbath regulations, for doing work on the Sabbath. And so in a similar way, the Jewish leaders wanted to put Jesus to death for doing what in their view was breaking the Sabbath. Now, Jesus' defense, on the other hand, which we'll get to next week, and as we continue on in the gospel, is his defense is the true nature of the Sabbath. You know, that they had a misunderstanding of what the Sabbath really was. And also a contention over the minutiae of the Sabbath rules that had been added to the law by the religious leaders, because by this time, basically why Moses and them to begin with in that number said they didn't know what to do with them. When God says do no work on the Sabbath, the question automatically becomes what? What's work? Right. Because is gathering wood really work? or so by the time of Jesus, I mean, there had just been this tremendous amount of regulation and rules that had been written by men, basically, to establish what the definition of work is. And it was ridiculous. I mean, it was just so, arbitrary in many cases. Like even in writing, a scribe, for instance, could write a certain number of characters if he was doing that, even translate, writing down the scripture. But there was a point where if you did one more character, you'd gone from not working to working. I mean, it's just kind of the minutiae that they had gotten into in this.
Didn't we talk before about God's purpose in a lot of these Old Testament? He inspired some of these Old Testament rules and regulations to put boundaries on man and to reign in them.
Yeah, that's right. Well,
so they got him.
Yeah, to put boundaries on men who were hopelessly under the control of sin, basically all fallen humanity is hopelessly bound to sin. And so God put parameters around those things around those men in the law, because they didn't have the capacity within themselves to walk in righteousness because they were slaves to sin. So what the good news, what the gospel declares, is now Jesus has set us free from sin and has imparted to us the righteousness of God. And therefore, now those parameters are no longer necessary, because now instead of outside regulations controlling our behavior, now we have the indwelling person of God who not only shows us what's right, but empowers us to walk in accordance with that right, what is right. So the fence that God had put around was incredibly defined, to the nth degree by the religious leaders over time. And that's where the contention came in. So Jesus basically saying, by the way, I'm not breaking the Sabbath. I'm breaking your definition of what work on the Sabbath is.
But what they're really doing here is it's a witch hunt, like. They're going after him. He's threatening their establishment, their religious order and power. And so they're out trying to find things.
Yeah. Well, that gets exposed as their motivation over time. I'm not sure that's actually what's happening here at this moment. I think they're really just kind of zealously, zealously applying their laws, their rules. And they don't like the fact that him breaking them is a threat to their authority, which grows over time. They recognize how much of a threat he is. So that's the first charge. The second charge against Jesus is the one that's actually more serious, which is the charge of blasphemy. The first is breaking the Sabbath. And the second defense, the second charge is blasphemy. And because Jesus, in his defense of his Sabbath activity, actually invokes the fact that God is his father. Look at verse 17. In his defense, Jesus said to them, "My father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working." For this reason, they tried all the more to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own father, making himself equal with God. All right, so why would the Jews get so enraged that Jesus called God his father? Because there are many places in the scripture, in the Old Testament, which describes God as Father. You know, so why would they get so upset about that? Well, from the Jewish perspective, God was the father of the nation of Israel. So he was the father kind of in a big corporate sense, rather than being father in an intimate, personal way, which is what Jesus was claiming. When he calls God Abba, it was claiming a very intimate, personal relationship with God that was outside of their understanding of who God was and different than it. And so, you know, for the Jews to claim an intimate father-son relationship with God would be this, like saying, okay, a father and son relationship on earth where there's an equality that comes by sharing the name and the lineage. And so that's what they're saying, that, you know, calling God his father, he's in essence making himself equal with God. And so, you know, Jesus did absolutely reveal the personal nature of God's fatherhood. And he did so not just for him, but also for us, the rest of God's children, right? Because now he instructs us to pray in the same way that he did. When you pray, say Abba, because we have this intimate relationship with God as our father. And so that was a truth that the Jewish leaders just didn't accept. But for Jesus, it was the basis of his defense of the first charge of the Sabbath, breaking the Sabbath activity, because what he says is, my father's at work. You know, so when God created on the seventh day, he did what? He rested. He entered into his rest because his work was complete. But the Jews, and we understand that God actually hasn't stopped doing work, because he's still working to hold together, you know, the universe. He's still active. He's still doing things. And so Jesus is just acknowledging that truth. God has entered into his rest, but even in his rest, he's working. And that's what I'm doing. I'm working on the Sabbath in order to fulfill the Father's purposes and God's work, which was Jesus' work, which is totally appropriate on the Sabbath or any time, is to set his children free from the power of sin and death. To set people free from the consequences of that. And so Jesus' work was to do that as well. And the thing is, we're to do that likewise too. You know, we're always at work to join the Father and our Lord in his mission to help people get set free from sin and death. And then getting free from sin and death, getting free from the power of the evil one in their life. And so Jesus' contention and the point here is if our man-made rules get in the way of that mission, then there's something wrong with the rules and with those who are applying them. it's wild when you think about this, the various applications of Sabbath rules, even in our history. How long ago were the blue laws, abolished? I mean, it's not that long ago, right? men and women, we just have a real propensity of wanting to hang on to the rules that we establish, right? And giving them primacy over maybe what is behind the reason for the rule in the first place, which was behind the reason for the rule in the first place is the person of God and his activity and purposes, which are always where we should, where our focus should be. Okay. All right. So next week we'll see the defense and the testimony of Jesus, how he presents his defense in order to confront the prosecution of the Jewish leaders. All right. Any questions?
Yeah, start in with one thing.
Sure.
The whole, reading where the Lord actually condemns the man to be stoned outside of the camp.
Yeah.
I'm struggling with that because, okay, breaking the Sabbath obviously is sin, but
it's hard to justify. So the question is, why did he condemn the man to death? I don't have a great answer for that, other than, you know, the man was already dead. You know, God's perspective, you know, God's perspective on this. So everybody pre-Jesus. You know, you wonder, why did God command the Israelites to go into Canaan and kill everybody? Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like there's no justice in that. It seems like there's no mercy. It seems like there's no love. Well, looking at it from our perspective, yeah, maybe. But from God's perspective, his perspective is the ultimate purpose of what needs to happen over time in order to bring his son into the world, in order to bring people back to life. Everybody before Jesus and everybody outside of Jesus after Jesus is already dead. And so, you know, when we think about, okay, God ordered them to be put to death, you think, you know, we tend to think, okay, well, that's not right. But, you know, from God's perspective, they were already dead, mm-hmm. and they have been dead, and there's no hope of them being alive. You know, there was no hope of that man that got stoned of becoming alive in Jesus Christ, because it was going to be thousands of years before Jesus Christ showed up on the scene. Mm-hmm. And so that's the only thing I can explain it. You know, our understanding of justice is different from God's, because his perspective over time and space and his redemptive purposes in the world are so different from ours. We, you know, he has just a different, so I can't explain why that's the case.
But do you feel like he's temporarily, quote unquote, dead, and then at some point his soul is potentially saved?
I don't think that's the case. You know, we know that everyone is going to rise to face the judgment. Okay, there's going to be a resurrection of the righteous and the unrighteous at the end in order to face the final judgment. And so the people in his case, I don't think that's an option for him. You know, I don't think that's, you know, that person has the opportunity to meet Jesus. Now, again, I can't explain why that is. But I don't think, you know, we've got to base our understanding on what Scripture says. And we can't imagine for God. You know, we just have to accept what he's revealed to us, even though we don't understand it. And so, you know, I feel like that's what's revealed in terms of the nature of that. You know, that should just make us all the more thankful that we get to experience the mercy of Jesus.
Put it in a chronological order as far as Old Testament was first.
Yeah.
The New Testament replaces the Old Testament. There are a lot of things that happened in the Old Testament.
That's right.
That you can't jive with the New Testament.
No, that's right. And so that's why, you know, it's so, you know, it's just so detrimental when people who are proclaiming the New Testament actually apply Old Testament values to the New Testament ethic or try to, it works. You know, we want to read the Old Testament through the lens of the new and understand it in light of God's grace and mercy, which we thankfully have gotten to experience. But that should just propel us to, you know, to share Jesus more with people. Because death is still all around us. People who are enslaved to sin and death are all around us, and there is no hope for them in terms of their eternal well-being without Jesus. So it's not unjust, because everybody, I mean, even we've all done what's deserving of death, right? I mean, so, you know, so winding up in death is not unjust. It's just, We somehow, by the grace of God, get to experience the mercy of Jesus. And that should be the main message on our lips and hearts and of our institutions, is not the rules to follow. It's the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, which we proclaim and hopefully make available to those around us. So, Father, we thank you for who you are. And even though so much of how you've interacted with mankind throughout the course of history is a mystery up to us, Lord, we just pray for the grace to trust you, to accept what you've made available to us in your Son through your mercy and grace, and to have that testimony characterize who we are in our lives, so that those around us can can enter into the mercy and grace that you've made available in him. So Lord, as we read this gospel, Lord, I pray that you just impart to us the heart of Jesus, that we'd be blessed through your spirit and by your grace to think like him, to have our emotions match his, and to recognize, Lord, the things that we put up before others that are actually roadblocks to them experiencing your love and grace. And Lord, help us to minister that love and grace to those around us, because we so appreciate experiencing it ourselves. And so, Lord, send us out in the power of your love and in the power of your mercy and grace, Lord, to live out the week ahead of us, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. All right.